All righty, well, we're underway with the first regathering, session 8, page 62 in your notebook, page 62. All right, let's do a quick review. We're now in the third major section of our study, section 3, the end of exile, 1839 to 1947, covering the modern Zionist movement, usually dated for convenience beginning in 1839. Now, last week, we saw that from the beginning, two strands of Zionism began. One strand was religious Zionism, and the other strand was secular Zionism, and they still exist today in 2014. Now, religious Zionism, the main motivator for religious Zionism was redemption. We want to get back to the land of Israel so that the Messiah will come. So the redemption is their motivation, and that was highlighted by Rabbi Judah Alkali saying, tradition allows us to return to the land before the Messiah comes. If we get 22,000 Jews in the land, then the Holy Spirit will come down upon the people. So that was his position, and that was a big shift in Jewish thinking. He was paralleled by Rabbi Zvi Hirsch Kalischer, who wrote, pay no attention to the tradition of waiting for the Messiah. We can go back. We don't have to wait for him to come, which was the traditional view. So that's religious Zionism and their motivation. And here, of course, is Rabbi Judah Alkali. We looked at him last week. And Rabbi Zvi Hirsch Kalischer. We looked at him in more detail last week. Now, in regard to the other side of the coin, secular Zionism. Now, secular Zionism's motivation for the modern state of Israel is anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism, that the world hates us, so we better have our own nation where we can live in safety. And this was emphasized by Moses Hess. Remember, he said he lived in Germany, and he wrote that our physical existence is at stake. And remember, he was anticipating Kristallnacht by 70 years. He was anticipating the Holocaust by 70 years. So he had a bit of sechel, a bit of common sense there. So that was his position. And another man who was a big influence in the modern Zionist movement, Leo Pinsker. He was stating, what people fear, they hate. He saw the failure of Haskalah assimilationism, and he turned to Zionism as the hope for the Jewish people. And again, here is Moses Hess, the man in Germany, the Jewish man in Germany, and then here is Leon Pinsker in the Ukraine. So these four men were heavily influenced the foundation of Zionism. We also saw that the Orthodox who were living in the land began to see that the Chalukah charity system was not going to be viable, and they began to create independent plots of land outside of the Old City. And of course, here is a map of the Old City of Jerusalem. And the first plot of land that was purchased outside the Old City of Jerusalem was Nachalat Shiva. And I managed to find the street addresses of the corners of Nachalat Shiva. So that's about where it sits in the modern city of Jerusalem, right on top of the Ben Yehuda pedestrian mall there. So that was the first plot of land purchased outside of the Old City. Now, we also saw that the agricultural school, Mikveh Yisrael, was started by the French Jewish philanthropy. Then the second plot of land outside the Old City was purchased, and that was Mea Shearim. Again, it is now an Orthodox enclave in the modern city of Jerusalem. So now we have two plots of land and two independent communities living outside the Old City. Petach Tikva, there was an attempt to plant this town, but it failed. Petach Tikva will come back to life later on. Then we looked at Eliezer ben Yehuda and the massive contribution he made to the modern state of Israel by bringing back from the dead, really, the modern Hebrew language. And he's credited with this tremendous work, this 17-volume set called The Complete Dictionary of Ancient and Modern Hebrew. And this is the gold standard for modern Hebrew that's spoken today. This is the basis for it. The many, many, many years and the thousands of hours of work that Eliezer ben Yehuda put into this dictionary.
So
So that brings us to where we start today. We start on page 62, and we're at the bottom of page 62 with the beginning of the first Aliyah. The beginning of the first Aliyah. All right. Between 1882 and 1903, some 25,000 Jews entered Palestine. Now, this was the single largest influx since the Spanish expulsion in 1492. Remember 1492 and Columbus sailed the ocean blue? And the Spaniards kicked us out of Spain at the same time. So that large number of Jewish people then went to Israel. So this is the largest influx of Jewish people into Palestine since 1492. Now, the upsurge in immigration is usually described as the first Aliyah, the first immigration wave. Now, the term Aliyah comes from a Hebrew word that means to go up. For example, here's what we're talking about. See, the center point of the Bible and the center point of the Jewish people is the city of Jerusalem there in the Judean hills, okay, in that little red circle. So in order to go to Jerusalem, to go to the center of your world, you always have to go up, whether it be from north, south, east, or west. No matter what direction you come, for example, on the west there, on the plain of Sharon, the Philistine plain, you go up the Judean hills to get to Jerusalem. In the south, in the Negev, again, you go up the Judean hills to get to Jerusalem. In the north, in the Jezreel Valley, again, you're going to climb the Judean hills to go up to Jerusalem. And then most dramatically, from the Jordan River Valley, you go up thousands of feet to get to Jerusalem. So whenever the Bible talks about going up to Jerusalem or down to Jerusalem, it means going to the city or going away from the city. It's a different orientation that we have here in the West. We're oriented north, south, east, and west. So if I'm going to go to Seattle, I'm going to go up to Seattle, and I'm going to come down to Orange County. Well, not so here. Here you go up to Jerusalem or down from Jerusalem. So the word Aliyah then, which means to go up, became a term describing immigration. And it's true even till today. If I told you, well, guys, I'm going to retire and I'm going to make Aliyah, I'd be telling you I'm going to go become a citizen of Israel. Or, you know, Jacob made Aliyah. Well, that means he became a citizen. He went up. He went up to the land. So it's still a technical term even today. So the term, the first Aliyah, here's some pictures of some of those early pioneers of the first Aliyah. Just a hearty bunch of courageous young Jewish people. Here they're having their lunch apparently. Probably early farmers in the land. So courageous people, one of the few pictures we have of some of the pioneers of the first Aliyah. Now, the first Aliyah consisted of two main waves of people, one from 1882 to 1884 and one from 1890 to 1891. Now, the first Aliyah immigrants were from Russia, and there are two reasons why we came from Russia. First of all, the Russian pogroms of 1881. Now, you may be thinking, now what is that word? Bob's throwing another weird word at me, pogrom. Well, what is a pogrom? Again, just from the World English Dictionary, just in a generic sense, a pogrom is an organized persecution or extermination of an ethnic group, especially of Jews. You'll find this word showing up in our history over and over and over again. Now, how many of you guys saw Fiddler on the Roof? Have watched Fiddler on the Roof? Okay, what happened after the wedding? Remember the wedding? Everybody celebrating, and in come the Russians with the pogrom, okay? An organized persecution. And remember the scene earlier than that when Reb Tevye and Leza Wolf were celebrating in the tavern? And Reb Tevye is heading home a little bit tipsy. And what happens? The constable comes up to him and says, oh, by the way, there's going to be a little action in the near future, but I wouldn't worry too much about it. It won't be much. You know, and kind of ruin the whole night for him. Well, see, he was warning him about the pogrom that was to come at the wedding. Okay, so you all, if you don't know what a pogrom is, watch Fiddler on the Roof. Okay, promise? Everybody who has not watched Fiddler on the Roof? Okay, you're going to all watch. That's your homework, okay? All right, so that's a pogrom. an organized persecution or extermination of an ethnic group, especially used in the case of the Jewish people. Secondly, the second reason why we left Russia was the renewed anti-Jewish policy of the Russian government as reflected in the May Laws published in May 1882. Now, the May Laws imposed new political restrictions and disabilities on the Jews of Russia and brought to an abrupt end an era of liberalism, and in the preceding decade under Tsar Alexander II. So the previous 10 years had been pretty decent for the Jewish people in Russia. That came to an end. So these new developments caused many Jews in Russia to despair of any hope of permanent improvement of the position in Russia. Now, the expulsion of the Jews from Moscow in 1891 provided a fresh impetus to Jewish immigration from Russia and sent more Jews to Israel, thus completing the first Aliyah. Now, the immigrants of the first Aliyah were mainly middle-class men, teachers, students, artisans, and tradesmen. Some of these had enough of their own means to enable them to settle in the country. Many of the immigrants came under the influence of the Chovevi Tzion organizations. Now, all but 5% of the newcomers settled in the towns of Jerusalem, Jaffa, Hebron, and Haifa. So we weren't an agricultural country yet. Now, at this time, it became evident that the unorganized Chovevi Tzion organizations, while attracting a lot of interest and a lot of followers, were ineffective agents for immigration. So this led to the formation of the Bilu. So turn to page 64, top of the page. The Bilu, organized in Russia. Now, this was a group of youthful idealists that decided to take the initiative to establish a creative foothold in the land of Israel. Now, in January of 1882, 30 young men and women gathered in Kharkov, Russia, in the lodgings of a university student, Israel Belkind, to discuss the plight of the nation. Now, here is the Ukraine. This is the same Ukraine we're hearing about in the news today that is on the brink of civil war. And Kharkov is in the eastern part of the Ukraine. So this is where these young Jewish people met. It was called Russia, of course, in those days. Now, there in Kharkov, they formed an immigration society known as the Bilu. It's a Hebrew biblical acrostic for House of Jacob, let us go up, based on Isaiah chapter 2, verse 5. So that's where they got their name, House of Jacob, let us go up. Isaiah chapter 2, verse 5. That was an acrostic. Beit Yaakov Lachu Vanelcha is the Hebrew. Beit Yaakov Lachu Vanelcha, Bilu. So that was the name of their organization. That was 30 of them. 19 of the youths made a commitment to abandon their studies or professions in favor of immediate departure for the land of Israel. The others would stay, and they would recruit new members to establish a model agricultural country in the land, colony in the land. In July of 1882, they shifted their headquarters from Kharkov to Odessa. Now, here's Kharkov, and Odessa is across on the southern side of the Ukraine or of Russia here. Remember, we've seen Odessa in the previous lessons. Situated on the Black Sea, this will become a very, very, very important hub of Zionism in the years to come. So you'll see this, you'll hear this name repeated over and over again. Odessa, very important city. All right, at the end of July 1882, 17 members of the group sailed for Constantinople. Remember, we started with 30. Now only 17 are getting on the boat. From there, an advance guard of 13 men and one woman, sailed for Israel. They reached Jaffa 5 days later. So started with 30, they're now down to 13. Intent upon securing at least a minimum of agricultural experience before launching a farm of their own, the young pioneers eventually received their first opportunity at Mikvah Yisrael, the training school that had been established 12 years earlier by the French Alliance. However, the French teachers had no sympathy for their ideals, you know, an independent farm. And the Biluites were driven mercilessly in their field work, 11 to 12 hours a day, until they neared collapse. One of them wrote, "The overseers kept pressing us, giving us not a moment's rest. They had been instructed to drive this spirit of folly out and leave out of us and compel us to leave." So the spirit of folly was the independent agricultural community they wanted to start. Now, in the summer of 1882, the Biluites had little reason to be optimistic. Sickness was undermining their will to go on. They had no funds to enable them to develop a model colony of their own. Now, at this point, let me show you a picture of some Biluites. This is not the original group, but these are a number of the pioneers associated with the Biluim, and they were really the forerunners of the kibbutz movement. They wanted to start independent farm communities. So again, a brave bunch of young Jewish pioneers. All right, top of page 65. Almost at the last moment, help materialized in the form of two Jerusalem Jews, Zalman Levantine and Joseph Feinberg. During the previous year, these men had collected money for a land purchase from investors in Jerusalem and in Europe. And they managed to acquire a 100-acre tract of land 8 miles inland, 8 miles inland from Jaffa. They erected their shacks there, and they dubbed their new settlement Rishon LeZion, first to Zion. And this is the approximate location of Rishon LeZion, again on a modern map of Israel. Here is Rishon LeZion as it looks today. In the background there, you can see the original Great Synagogue and the original square for the city in the foreground. So Rishon LeZion is a thriving little town today. Let's take a look at its history. It wasn't easy to get going. Now, at this point, touched by the plight of the Biluites, Levantine and Feinberg persuaded the others at Rishon LeZion to allow the youngsters to join their venture. So immediately, 11 of the Biluites took up shelter in a makeshift dormitory hut that had been set aside for them. Pooling their last resources, they cleared the soil and they planted maize and vegetables. But unfortunately, the harvest season had passed. After 2 months, both food and money were exhausted, and Rishon LeZion faced the very real threat of starvation. Completely dispirited, 5 of the original pioneer group decided to return to Mikvah Yisrael and 6 to Russia. Now, at the same time, Petach Tikva, which had been abandoned several years earlier, was being resettled by newcomers from Europe. Remember that? Petach Tikva will come alive again. But they fared no better than Rishon LeZion. Disease, heat, exhaustion, and robbery sapped their will and their resources. So these Jewish settlers were preparing to abandon an evidently hopeless cause. Now, 1883, the middle of page 65. Their rescue came from an unanticipated source, Baron Edmund de Rothschild. And you have a picture of him on page 65, the extremely rich Jewish banking Rothschilds. Baron Rothschild. In the summer of 1882, he granted an audience to Joseph Feinberg, one of the two founders of Rishon LeZion. Now, Feinberg had gone to Europe in a desperate fundraising effort to save the colony. Rothschild, the rich and eminent banker, was moved to tears by Feinberg's account of the pioneer self-sacrifice. And immediately he offered 30,000 francs for the purpose of drilling a well at Rishon LeZion, and he implied that more help would be on the way. Soon afterward, Rothschild dispatched an expert French agronomist to Israel to instruct the Bilu farmers, and then he hired the director of Mikvah Yisrael as the overseer of Rishon LeZion. In return for his help, Rothschild stipulated only that his contributions not be made public. And that wish was honored for many years. Somewhat cryptically, the settlers referred to their patron as Hanadiv Hayadua, the well-known benefactor. That's how he was known. All right, top of page 66. Of course, Petach Tikva heard about this, and Petach Tikva also turned to Rothschild for help. So in 1888, 28 families relied on him for their daily income. However, Rothschild's support was not a blank check for the colonists to operate their farms according to their own judgments. The experts he sent from France and from Mikveh Yisrael became the overseers. They were charged with the day-to-day operations of the settlements. And before long, a radical change took place in the farmer's status. Eventually, they were stripped of all authority to determine which crops they might plant and sell. That all became the decision of the overseers. And this kind of paternalism not only eroded the farmers' initiative, it undermined their morale as well. They resented their dependence upon the caprice of the overseers. Now, they were well aware that they might starve without Rothschild's help, but the colonists openly voiced bitterness at their transformation into serfs. Now, the nine Biluites continuing on at Rishon LeZion and in Mikveh Yisrael were fully despairing under Rothschild's supervision as they had been under during their earlier and hungrier days. So this is not exactly what they were hoping for. All right, 1884. Middle of page 66. But then again, in the fall of 1884, an alternative solution developed quite unexpectedly. Yechiel Pines, a Russian Jew who had immigrated to the land in 1878, had brought with him a modest sum of money collected from various Chovevi Tzion groups. With this and other borrowed funds, Pines had established a craftsman society for the Biluites in Jerusalem in 1882. Now, with the remainder of the money, he purchased 700 acres of land near Yavne, which is a few miles inland from the coast, and he turned that over to the Biluites. In December of 1884, their number now reduced to 8. Remember, in Kharkov they started with 30. It's now down to 8. The Biluites set up a single wooden shack on the site, and they called their farm Gedera, sheepfold. So on the map on the left, you can see the square, the part of Israel we're looking at. And then in the square on the right, you can see some of the towns, Gedera being toward the bottom of the picture. There's the location of Gedera, sheepfold. You can see, also see Rishon LeZion and Petah Tikva there as well. Now, deprived of access to Rothschild's experts, the Biluites misplanted their subsistence crops, and in the end, they were reduced to meals of radishes and potatoes. At the beginning of 1886, their situation was desperate. It appeared that Gedera would not survive. But Gedera did survive, but only through the generosity of Rothschild. You know, they turned to him for money. The handful of settlers that remained abandoned the notion of a cooperative community. Like the colonists of Rishon LeZion, Petach Tikva, and other villages, they began to accept handouts from Paris, and they began to hire cheap Arab labor. Now, the original Biluites refused to surrender their ideals. At the end of the 1880s, all of them had abandoned Gedera, some for the cities, some for Western Europe, but their experiment had apparently had failed. Now, turn back. You've turned past the handout. And turn back to page, in between page 66 and 67 there. And we're now at the handout about William Eugene Blackstone. Everybody there? Okay. Now, the reason I inserted him here is because he's a local guy. And because he had an amazing impact upon modern Zionism. Here is his picture, William E. Blackstone. He was the first dean of the Bible Institute of Los Angeles, BIOLA. First dean of BIOLA. This is, of course, when BIOLA was in L.A. But he had quite an impact on Zionism. So I thought we would go through some excerpts from this article. So let's take a look at the first paragraph at the top there. William Eugene Blackstone was an American evangelist and Christian Zionist. He was the author of the proto-Zionist Blackstone Memorial of 1891. Blackstone was influenced by Dwight Lyman Moody, D.L. Moody. Of course, D.L. Moody founded the Moody Bible Institute. James H. Brooks and John Nelson Darby. So he was a Bible-believing dispensationalist. Drop down now to one, two, three, the fourth paragraph. It starts in 1878. Everybody there, 1878? Okay. In 1870, he wrote, "Jesus is Coming." His book became the veritable reference source of American dispensationalist thought. Over the next 50 years, "Jesus is Coming" sold multi-millions of copies worldwide and was translated into 48 languages. Next paragraph. He initially focused on the restoration of the Jews to the Holy Land as a prelude to their conversion to Christianity. He had that right, by the way, out of a pious wish to hasten the coming of the Messiah. But he increasingly became concerned with the deadly Russian government-instigated pogroms, and he believed that it was necessary to create a Jewish homeland in Palestine. All right, next paragraph, Blackstone. Blackstone and his daughter traveled to the Holy Land in 1888. He returned convinced that a return of the Jewish people to its ancient homeland was the only possible solution to the persecution Jews suffered elsewhere. On November 24th and 25th, 1890, Blackstone organized the Conference on the Past, Present, and Future of Israel at the First Methodist Episcopal Church in Chicago, where participants included leaders of both Jewish and Christian communities, although not leaders of the Reform movement. Next paragraph, one sentence. The conference issued a call urging the great powers, including the Ottoman Empire, to return Palestine to the Jews. Bottom paragraph, or the next paragraph down. A year later, in 1891, Blackstone led a petition drive that was approved by the conference. It was later known as the Blackstone Memorial. The memorial was signed by 413 prominent Christian and a few Jewish leaders in the United States. Blackstone personally gathered the signatories of men such as John D. Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, Cyrus McCormick, senators, congressmen, religious leaders and of all denominations, newspaper editors, the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, and others for the Blackstone Memorial. He presented the memorial to President Harrison. Bottom paragraph. March 1891. Calling for American support of Jewish restoration to Palestine. His petition presaged and paralleled the later ideas of Theodore Herzl, the founder of the State of Israel, whose establishment of modern Zionism was outlined in his book, Der Judenstaat, in 1896. We'll take a look at that in just a few minutes. All right, next page. Turn the page and go to the top paragraph. The Blackstone Memorial read in part, "Why shall not the powers which under the Treaty of Berlin in 1878 gave Bulgaria to the Bulgarians and Serbia to the Serbs now give Palestine back to the Jews? These provinces as well, Romania, Montenegro, and Greece, were wrested from the Turks and given to their natural owners. Does not Palestine as rightfully belong to the Jews?" Drop down now two paragraphs to the paragraph starting with "Learning of the Rise." Learning of the rise of the Zionist movement led by Theodore Herzl, Blackstone became an outspoken and ardent supporter of Zionism. When Herzlian Zionism considered the offer by the British government of an interim Jewish state in Uganda, he campaigned against it. He sent to Herzl a personal Bible outlined with the specific biblical references to Jewish restoration to Palestine only. The Bible was said to have been prominently displayed on Herzl's desk for many years. It is no longer locatable. Skip the next paragraph, go down to Supreme Court. Supreme Court Justice Louis D. Brandeis rediscovered the Blackstone Memorial in 1916 during the period of his raucous and at times anti-Semitic congressional appointment hearings. Brandeis, as head of the American Zionist Movement, utilizing the intercession of Nathan Strauss, who first brought Brandeis's attention to the potential of the potential to the potential significance of the Blackstone Memorial of 1891, sought out and formed an alliance with Blackstone. Drop down two paragraphs now to Brandeis. Brandeis requested that Blackstone reissue a modern Blackstone Memorial to President Wilson. Brandeis understood the fundamentals of power politics and grassroots American Christian and American political support. Brandeis understood the support that Blackstone would raise for the memorial would enable President Wilson to accept and endorse American Zionism and later British Balfour Declaration of 1917, which set the course for the establishment of the State of Israel. Though 75 years of age, Reverend Blackstone energetically undertook the strenuous project. Of particular note, Blackstone secured the endorsement of his memorial to President Wilson from the Presbyterian Church. President Wilson was a religiously observant Presbyterian. The memorial, though presented to President Wilson only privately, was very effective in garnering President Wilson's support and, in turn, reassuring the British of American support for the Balfour Declaration. Next paragraph. Blackstone remained committed to Jewish restoration and Zionism for the balance of his long life. As a believing evangelical Christian, he witnessed the seeming fulfillment of biblical prophecy as the Jewish state came back to life after 1900 years. Blackstone died 13 years before the Jewish state of Israel was reborn in 1948. Without Reverend Blackstone's lifelong efforts to build American political support and American prophetic understanding of dispensationalism and restorationism, American support for Zionism and the State of Israel might have been very different. Famous during his life, he slipped into historical obscurity. The forgotten founder of BIOLA, right? Final paragraph. Reverend Blackstone died November 7th, 1935. He was buried in a modest grave where? Forest Lawn Cemetery in Glendale. Just up the road here, 45 minutes in Glendale. All his evangelical life, Blackstone described himself as God's little errand boy. And here is his grave up in Forest Lawn Cemetery, just a very humble grave by a man who has basically dropped out of historical notice. But he was a Christian, he was a Gentile, he was a great supporter of Zionism, and very influential in the Zionist movement and the formation of the modern state of Israel. So I just felt that because he was a local guy, it would be really appropriate to put him in here. All righty, I'm going to let you take a 10-minute break. So take your break and be back when you hear the shofar. All right, let's pick it up. Let's pick it up now on page 67 of your notebook. Katowice Conference. Page 67. All right, it was apparent now that idealism and motivation and dedication, and the Chovev Tzion pioneers had that, but it was apparent that idealism, motivation, and dedication were inadequate to bring about independent immigration to Israel. Now, at this point, Leo Pinsker took the initiative, and he summoned a national conference of the various Chovev Tzion societies. To circumvent the Russian authorities, the meeting was convened in Katowice, a German city. 34 delegates attended the initial gathering. They reached a consensus that financing Jewish settlement in Israel was their first priority. Only in the land of Israel, it was agreed that the people of Israel could be transformed into a viable society and nation. The organization's central office was established in Odessa. As president there of the Chovev Tzion, Pinsker was charged with directing a growing stream of Jewish immigrants into the Holy Land. In the 1890s, the Chovev Tzion grew rapidly in many parts of Europe and overseas. And Dr. Nathan Birnbaum, a leader in the movement, first coined the term Zionism. So Zionism came out of the Chovev Tzion movement. Now notice, if you're following along, the next two sentences are very, very important. Note this. By the time Theodore Herzl appeared on the scene in the 1890s, he encountered in Europe and in America the nucleus of a thoroughly respectable Zionist movement. Its various societies provided him with the largest numbers of his followers, including 90% of the delegates attending the first Zionist Congress in 1897. So when Theodore Herzl comes on the scene, God has laid a very, very sound foundation for him. All right, 1889, bottom of page 67. So in 1889, the Zionist dream of a Jewish national home was shaky. The crisis was perceived at the very outset by Asher Ginzburg, a leading member of the Chovev Zion in Russia. And you have this picture of Asher Ginzburg in your workbook. He's also known as Ahad Ha'am. That's his pen name, Asher Ginzburg. Now, he was born in the Ukraine to a Hasidic family, an ultra-Orthodox family. He was married off at the age 17 to a girl he had never set eyes on until the day of the wedding. That was a typical ultra-Orthodox procedure. Then he was locked in a modest family business for which he exhibited neither enthusiasm nor aptitude. He became an insatiable reader in virtually all European languages. He had a great mind. Eventually, he took up residence in Odessa. And Odessa was the major Jewish intellectual center of the day. Only upon reaching Odessa did Ginzburg become an active member of the Chovev Zion. He then began to devote his phenomenal scholarship to one cause, the solution of the Jewish problem. Now, Ginzburg wrote under the pen name of Ahad Ha'am, one of the people. In 1889, in an article entitled Lo Ze Derech, This Is Not the Way, Ahad Ha'am warned his fellow Zionists about the failure of Zionism's infiltrationist methods of establishing a Jewish homeland. So page 68. Infiltration is not going to work, was his point. It's not the way. He insisted that the Jewish national revival in Europe by itself was not capable of supporting a major pioneering venture in the Holy Land. One recourse was open, Ahad Ha'am insisted, and that was to mobilize the help of Western Jews in organizing an international society for building the Yishuv. So he's thinking bigger now than anybody has ever thought. Only such a body was capable of negotiating a charter of Jewish settlement with the Ottoman Empire, and afterward of buying and preparing land for systematic and orderly habitation. His purpose was to ensure that the national spirit of the Jewish people was fully ignited. The essay aroused widespread resentment among the members of the Chovev Zion. Now, he was taken somewhat aback by this reaction, and he later modified his views. Because, of course, the Chovev Zion were committed to their infiltrationist methods. He proceeded to elaborate upon his conception of the land of Israel as essentially a national spiritual center for the revival of Judaism throughout the world. That, he felt, was the proper goal of the Zionist movement. His obsession with spiritual and cultural awakening began to have its impact, even among the most relentless practical Zionists. So remember, there's two groups of Zionists now. There's the secular group and the religious group. His pen name soon became the most important in the Zionist world. Chaim Weizmann said this about him. He had the profoundest effect on the Russian Jewish students in Europe. The appearance of one of Ahad Ha'am's articles was always an event of prime importance. He was read and discussed endlessly. He was what Gandhi had been to many Indians, what Mazzini was to young Italy a century ago. So he was really a father of the nation in many ways. Now, to cultivate the spiritual cultural ideal that Ahad Ha'am professed, in 1889, he founded a select elitist group, the B'nai Moshe, within Chovev Zion. And the society's accomplishments were very important. It founded a national land purchasing fund. which later was handed over to the official Jewish National Fund. So when you plant a tree in Israel, this is where the whole idea first started, right here. They published a series of newspapers in Jaffa, giving accurate information on the developments in the Yishuv. They established the first Hebrew language school, also in Jaffa, and later a collection of Hebrew libraries throughout the land. They organized a nucleus of secular Hebrew language day schools in Russia, as well as the influential Achi Asaf, the Hebrew language publishing company. This Russian Jewish essayist became the conscience of tens of thousands among the East European Jews who flocked to the Zionist movement. He insisted that political Zionism, far from developing naturally out of Jewish tradition, was hardly more than an artificial concoction of Europeanized Western Jews. From the late 1890s then, Ahad Ha'am's campaign against mere political Zionism and Herzl's diplomatic leadership transformed him into the most feared and respected critic in the Zionist world. Ahad Ha'am was destined to become the most influential of the cultural, as distinguished from the political, Zionists. All right, page 69. Question? Yes. That's the settlement, basically the settlement. Yeah. Yeah. 1890, Rehovot and Hadera founded. During the latter part of the 1890s, emigration to Israel slowed down to a trickle. The Hovevi Zion organization remained in the doldrums. Denied legal status in Russia, it was unable to collect funds. However, in 1890, the Tsarist regime permitted Hovevi Zion to begin collecting money and conducting activities. From 1890 on, the organization had a permanent office in Odessa. In 1890 and 91, as a result, 3,000 Jewish and Romanian Jews departed for Israel. In 1890, the Odessa Committee, as the Hovevi Zion organization was known to the rest of the Zionist world, the Odessa Committee opened a bureau in Jaffa under the direction of Zvi Tiomkin. Unfazed by Ottoman government restrictions, he managed to purchase several large tracts of land on behalf of Hovevi Zion, and he resold this land to the settlers. In this fashion, two important farm colonies, Rehovot and Hadera, came into Jewish hands outside of the influence of the Rothschild administration. So the settlement of the land is getting more independent now. Okay, and here's a map of where Rehovot is located in the modern state of Israel. And here's a picture of Rehovot in its early years. So it was quite successful. Now here's Hadera up the coast a ways. Is Hadera, and if you drive up the freeway up the coast, you can spot Hadera a mile away because you can see the smokestacks of the Orot Rabin power station miles and miles away. So you know exactly where Hadera is. It's marked very clearly when you drive on the highway. Now, what I'm going to say now is not in your notes. I just want to make a little application. Some thoughts of application. Now, we've just seen God lay the foundation of the modern Zionist movement. He's used two rabbis, Zvi Hirsch Kalischer and Judah Alkali, to blaze the trail in regards to a new way of thinking from the passive view to the active practical view. He raised up the Hovevi Zion groups all over Russia. He raised up men to inspire thought and produce organization, Moses Hess, Leon Pinsker, Ahad Ha'am, William Blackstone. You know, these people didn't come to their position by accident. He created others to be pioneers, people who wanted to be on the cutting edge of the new nation, you know, the Biluites. These were men and women who struck out into the wilderness with sheer courage and determination and tried to settle the land. And that was the first Aliyah. And we've seen pictures of these brave pioneers. And so none of this happened by accident. None of this happened coincidentally. None of this happened apart from God's control. Otherwise, if we believe that, we're undermining the Bible teaching about God's omnipotence and omniscience. You know, he is in control of everything. So he used the people he determined to use, whether they trusted in him or not. He can use anybody. He can even use a donkey. Okay? You know? Balaam's donkey. And you know, the same is true with our lives on a personal level. God is in charge of our lives as well. He brings circumstances and people into our lives in order to guide us in the direction and to the destiny that he's determined for us. He can use anyone. He can use believer and unbeliever alike to guide the direction of our lives. Our responsibility lies in trusting him and obeying him to the best of our ability. So just as he brought life to Israel again after 2,000 years of desolation, he can bring new life to us, even if our lives have been desolated as well. So I want you to remember that as you think of the history of Israel. What has happened to Israel can happen personally to us as well. Okay, make sense? All right, now, we make a very, very, very important turn of the page when we come to page number 70. Big change. Big change in the history of the modern state. 1894, the Dreyfus Affair. Actually, Theodore Herzl and the Dreyfus Affair. He was an exceptionally striking in appearance, with large burning eyes and chiseled features and a rich Assyrian beard. His demeanor was consciously aristocratic. His self-assurance was magisterial to the point of arrogance. This was Theodore Herzl. Doesn't he just look that way in this picture? Magisterial, arrogant, burning eyes. Yep, it's a good picture of him. He was born in Budapest in 1860. He was the son of an affluent banking family. Now, his parents maintained a nominal Jewish allegiance, attending the Reform Temple each week, and observing the major Jewish festivals. Theodore Herzl underwent a bar mitzvah. He even attended Jewish communal school. Yet his ambitions were a little different than that. His ambitions and those of his family were to excel in the realm of German culture. He was an assimilationist to the core. He attended the University of Vienna in Austria, enrolling in the law school. Receiving his doctorate in jurisprudence in 1884, he accepted a quasi-official position in the Ministry of Justice, but he hated it. Virtually every free moment he spent in writing plays and literary essays. And before the year had passed, he abandoned the law entirely. Herzl's chosen medium of expression, he was a writer, was a popular European literary form that offered commentary on the social and cultural events of the time. And he became an instant success. In 1887, he took an editorial position with a newspaper and later held other senior editorial positions. In 1891, he accepted the envied position of Paris correspondent for Austria's leading newspaper. His wife was the beautiful, wealthy Julie Naschauer, but she was high-strung and unstable. Following the birth of their first two children, she lived in a state of near chronic hysteria. Couldn't handle the kids, I guess. Separations of the couple were frequent, and after the birth of their third child, they lived together only intermittently. So he had a very, very difficult family life. Now, Herzl was increasingly preoccupied with the Jewish question. During his university days, he had accepted the fashionable liberal view that religious and racial prejudices ultimately would vanish in an enlightened age. Yet the mounting intensity of nationalist anti-Semitism began to leave its mark. From 1892 on, his columns from Paris devoted increasing attention to the anti-Semitism in the French capital. Page 71. So Herzl's preoccupation, I should say despairing preoccupation with the Jewish question, predated the Dreyfus Affair. but it was markedly intensified by the arrest and degradation of that unfortunate French Jewish army captain. Alfred Dreyfus was an assimilated Jew who was falsely accused of spying. And Herzl was a reporter who covered the trial. Here is Captain Alfred Dreyfus, assimilated to the core, Frenchman to the core, committed to the French army totally, framed as a spy. Framed as a spy. When Dreyfus was found guilty, Herzl wrote of the anti-Semitism of the mob. The bystanders taunted Dreyfus with shouts of death to the Jews. And here's a drawing of the humiliation of Alfred Dreyfus. The French assigned the largest officer, the largest soldier they could find, a huge man. This huge man, and they marched Dreyfus out into the courtyard, and this huge army officer came up to him, ripped all the buttons off his uniform, ripped all the insignia off his uniform, and threw it to the ground in front of him, pulled out his sword and broke it in half, and they then marched him off to Devil's Island for a number of years. He was eventually acquitted of the so-called crime. But as this was happening, Herzl is in the crowd, and Herzl is hearing the bystanders shout, "Death to the Jews! Death to the Jews!" This was Herzl's critical moment of recognition. He saw most clearly that assimilation was not the solution to the Jewish question. Religious and racial prejudice would not disappear with the advent of a so-called enlightened age. For the first time in his adult life, he began attending Jewish religious services. He even began formulating a Jewish novel that envisioned the revival of the promised land for the suffering race. Sometime in the winter and spring of 1895, the Zionist idea took form in Herzl's mind. He began transcribing his thoughts on the Jewish question in a notebook. Here's from History of Israel by Sachar, quoting Herzl. "For some time now, I have been engaged in a work of indescribable greatness. It has assumed the aspect of some powerful dream. But days and weeks have passed since it has filled me utterly. It has overflown into my unconscious self. It accompanies me wherever I go. It broods above all prosaic conversation. It disturbs and intoxicates me. What it will lead to is impossible to surmise as yet. But my experience tells me that it is something marvelous, even as a dream, and that I should write it down. Title, The Promised Land." That's the beginning of his diary. Now, the opening pages describe a vision that left the author breathless, but it possessed him. Walking, standing, lying down, in the street, at the table, at nighttime, "I must above all master myself. I believe that for me, life has ceased and world history begun. The Jewish state is a world necessity." He's thinking big there, isn't he? Page 72. Now, an early chapter of the work was titled An Address to the Rothschilds. Herzl intended to read it to the banking family assembled in council, and if necessary, to rework it later into a book. In August of 1895, Herzl consulted Dr. Moritz Guterman, chief rabbi of Vienna, and read him the Address to the Rothschilds. The rabbi evidently was impressed, and he suggested the document be published. Herzl discussed the idea with his friend, Dr. Max Nordau. And Nordau was enthralled. Embracing his friend, he cried out, "If you are mad, we are mad together. Count on me. I am with you." And from then on, Nordau remained Herzl's most intimate collaborator. It was Nordau who proposed at this point that Herzl visit Israel Zangwill, an eminent Anglo-Jewish novelist, a man of considerable reputation among British Jewry. Now, his reception of Herzl's idea was courteous, but generally noncommittal. And so Herzl set about pruning and taming and organizing the notes for his Address to the Rothschilds into a formal 65-page essay. 1896, middle of the page there. What emerged from this effort was Der Judenstaat. And here is a copy, one of the original copies of the little pamphlet, Der Judenstaat, the Jew state. In English, it reads the Jew state. And you can get it in English if you're interested in it. It's available on Amazon, on Amazon.com. And he deliberately entitled it the Jew state because he was deliberately flinging the word Jew into the teeth of anti-Semites. And he was also flinging the word Jew into the teeth of the acculturated Western Jews who preferred more euphemistic titles such as Hebrew or Israelite. Here's what Herzl declared in his preface. The idea which I have developed in this pamphlet is an ancient one. It is the restoration of the Jewish state. I shall do no more than suggest what cogs and wheels comprise the machinery I propose, trusting that better mechanics than myself will be found to carry the work out. The world needs the Jewish state. Therefore, it will rise. So Herzl's central idea in Der Judenstaat is this. We are a people, one people. We have sincerely tried everywhere to merge with the national communities in which we live, seeking only to preserve the faith of our fathers. It is not permitted us. It is not permitted us. Page 73. Therefore, only one solution remained. It was an exodus, a gathering together of the Jews from their worldwide dispersion into a land of their own. Political principle would provide the basis, technology the means, and the driving force would be the Jewish tragedy. So as you can see from these quotes, Herzl was a Europeanized, non-traditional, agnostic Jew. Where was God? True, he would go to services, but the Lord really did not have a big part in his life. Now, Der Judenstaat was published in Vienna in February 14, 1896. English and French translations soon followed. So Der Judenstaat introduced Zionism to European readers, to editors, to university men, to statesmen, to other molders of public opinion in the kind of language that they were accustomed to reading. This is the contributing factor of the book. It communicated Zionism forcefully to Europeans because he was a European writer. However, the initial reception of Der Judenstaat was less than favorable. The Central European press, shocked by the aberration of one of its most distinguished, ridiculed Herzl as a Jewish Jules Verne. Now, you're familiar with Jules Verne, right? He wrote fantasy science fiction. He wrote what? He wrote The Time Machine, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Journey to the Center of the Earth, From Earth to Moon. He was way ahead of his time, right? So they call him this dreamer. Just like Jules Verne, a dreamer, writer of fantasy and fiction. Even Rabbi Guterman, whose loyalty Herzl felt was assured, had changed his mind. However, scorn and exasperation were by no means the only reaction. Der Judenstaat was received warmly by Kadima, the Zionist Student Society of Vienna. David Wolfson, a leading Zionist of Cologne, Germany, was entirely overwhelmed by Der Judenstaat. He immediately traveled to Vienna to see and meet Herzl. It was through Wolfson, then, that Herzl was introduced to the leader of the German Hovevision. And through them, he learned of, guess what, the writings of Leon Pinsker and Moses Hess, and the tremendous Zionist Renaissance in Eastern Europe. He was oblivious to it at this time. Now, although the Tsarist censorship forbade publication of Der Judenstaat in Russia, Central European Jews began smuggling copies of the book into Russia. And soon Herzl's name and legend grew. Telegrams and letters of thanks poured into Herzl from Hovevision societies in Bulgaria, Galatia, Russia, and Palestine. And they called upon the new Moses to accept leadership in the movement. So now we come to 1897. We'll come to that next week. And we'll take a look at the first Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland. So we'll pick that up next week. Now let's go ahead and let me pray, and then I will turn you loose. Good golly, it's 4 minutes early. How did I manage this? All right. Father, again, thank you for this glimpse into history. History is really the story of your work in the world. Thank you for putting together this foundation for the modern state of Israel. We've seen you bring all the pieces of the puzzle together, and now you're going to stick a leader in place. And Zionism is going to blast off. And so, Lord, as we see you at work in the world, help us always to remember what I said earlier, that you are in the same way at work in our lives. Help us to remember that no matter what happens in our life, you can bring good out of it, and you can use it for your glory. And you can bring a life that's been desolated and bring it back. So, Lord, help us to trust in you. As we see you work in the world, help us to trust in you in our own lives. So we lift ourselves up to you in Yeshua's name. Amen. All right, we'll see you next week.